You're listening to Trek FM.
This episode of To The Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your tablet, smartphone, and desktop. Support the show and get a free audiobook of your choice by visiting audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Robert Duncan McNeil, also known as Tom Paris from Star Trek Voyager. You're listening to Trek FM.
Maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To The Journey.
To the journey!
Oh, that was weak. Come on, give me more.
To The Journey! There we go.
As you could probably guess, that is not Char. Char is away this week. She took the Delta Flyer out for a spin, but I promise you she'll be back next week. What you heard is my good friend and other co-host, Matt Hansen.
Hi, Tristan. Thanks for having me on.
I am so glad you're here. You guys may know him from my other podcast, The Nerd Party, or from The Delta Quadrant.
Which, I gotta say, you're catching me. We're two episodes from the end. We're recording our review of Renaissance Man tonight, which means we're recording Endgame next Sunday. I cannot believe it. It's very surreal. So it's going to be fun with this episode going back and taking a look at a previous episode and going down memory lane, as it were.
I mean, speaking of journeys, that's been a hell of a journey for you guys. I mean, how long ago did you start?
I started 4 years ago. I was 22 when I started doing this podcast. I'm 26 now.
Jeez, man, 4 years. Yeah, we've been going over two now onto the journey, but 4 years, that's pretty crazy. I mean, how are you feeling about your ending? Like, bittersweet or...
Bittersweet, but you know, when you spend a good 4 years on a project and you put a lot of time and a lot of investment in, and you kind of get tired, and I now understand why people leave shows after three or four seasons. You know what I mean? Like it's time to move on. But that's not to say I haven't had a blast. I've had a great time. Everyone's been so good to me. And, I finally got to do a podcast, which is something that I've wanted to do for a long time. So... I'm very grateful.
Well, I'm really happy for you, and I'm really happy for all of you over there. And the Delta Quadrant is like a fine wine. It gets better with age. But we're here to talk about a commentary. That's right. We teased it 2 weeks ago, but we had to skip it last week because we did a Bridgemates rematch, and hopefully you've listened to it. And if you haven't, I definitely recommend it because it's a lot of fun, and I won't spoil on who wins, but I think you know who wins. But the episode we're doing is Message in a Bottle, which is one of my favorites, and I think a lot of people's favorites. It's from Season 4, Episode 14, and this is how Netflix describes it. Using an alien communications net, Voyager sends the Doctor to the Federation ship, the USS Prometheus, only to find that it has been taken by Romulans.
Yeah, I mean, I remember this episode when we did it for the show, and I gotta say, I have to think about it now that we're ending it, because I'm gonna try to rank some of my top five Voyagers, but this might be among them.
This is, I was always surprised at how much I liked this episode, but let's save it for the commentary, and as you guys know, because we do a lot of commentaries, what we do is we do a 3-2-1 play. And then you do it the same, whether you have your DVDs, your Netflix, your Hulu, your Amazon, whatever, wherever you got it, that's how we do it. So, Matt, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
All right. 3, 2, 1, play. If Char were here, she'd say, and there she is.
Stock shot of Voyager. Oh, yeah, this is when Torres was... in her work jacket while Roxanne Dawson was pregnant.
I remember seeing that for the first time, and I was like, that's weird. I wonder what those devices do, and I wonder why it is. And then all of a sudden she spun on a corner real hard, and then you saw like, oh, it's because she has a belly.
Right. Well, at least it's better. I like how they started compensating for actors' pregnancies before, because... With Next Gen and Gates McFadden, all they did was stuck her behind a desk for a lot of it. Which, she's not allowed to do a lot. And then with Kira, they worked it into the story.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was great in Deep Space Nine when they worked that into the
story. Yeah, I thought that was pretty brilliant. But, you know, this is a good compromise. At least Torres gets to do stuff.
It's true, and I think it was a good idea to add the jacket because, you know, like, if you had the wide shots or if she was turning corners 99% of the time, you wouldn't be able to tell. But, you know, we as an audience members all know what's going on, but it's really just for the aesthetic.
It's suspension of disbelief.
Exactly, it's suspension of disbelief, and I feel like people need to give that some more credit. I'm just glad that they didn't have to deal with a multi-camera format like in a sitcom. Like in a sitcom, I think one of my favorites was Titus, and the lead actress got pregnant, and so they had her sprain her ankle so that she could be in a wheelchair for a series of episodes.
Oh, that's sad.
And put her purse on her lap.
Jeez. Uh-oh, it's a Starfleet vessel.
I love the I know that some people call Star Trek a space opera, and when we see shots like that where everybody's looking off into the distance and we hear that drone in the music and everybody looks inquisitive, you know?
Well, how do you like those season? I think it's mostly season one, although there's probably some in season two where they just do the obligatory Kate Mulgrew deer in headlight shot.
I never really thought about it until people started giving pictures online.
It doesn't happen much later in the seasons. It happens very early is when I remember most of them.
Yeah, I mean, like once I started seeing a meme pop up online, I was just like, oh yeah, that's right. And whenever I do my rewatches, I can't help but notice it. So you guys ruined it for me.
Well, you know what Delta Quadrant ruined for me too, and I guess we could be off topic because we're just watching the credits at this point, is that I love Kate Mulgrew. Love her to death. Have met her a couple times, actually, and, you know, just got her autobiography on Audible, actually, which is fantastic. But watching the Delta Quadrant has ruined it for me, because as much as I love Kate Mulgrew, whenever she does pain noises or pain faces, it makes me laugh.
I know, right? Oh my gosh. It's just, since day one, that's one thing that was ruined for me, like, since Caretaker.
Okay, good. Like, then I'm not the only one, and I don't have to feel bad about it.
No, don't feel bad, because I think, like, Shar and I have even talked about it, where I've said, you know, Janeway's really not enjoying herself right now, but she's making noises that kind of make you think that she is enjoying herself.
Yeah, exactly. You all know what we're saying. It's subtext. But actually, like, when we watched Unimatrix Zero and she gets assimilated, that's the best one.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty
as
bad.
As far as pain noises go.
Now, I'm a big ship guy. I love ships. I love Star Trek ships. I used to design my own as a kid, you know, just like when I was doodling in class, that's what I would doodle, is my own nacelle design and my own hull design.
So,
and everything,
something
like that.
Something totally unique that's not been on screen then.
Yeah, I'm excited by this. And like the first time I saw this, I was like, holy crap, we've never seen this kind of design before. It has four nacelles. We haven't seen that since the Stargazer, I don't think. And not to mention
this looks sleeker than the Stargazer too.
Oh yeah, and I think, like, it's funny how if you track ship design from, if you put an Enterprise into the mix, it's practically flat, and then you go to the original Enterprise, and then they have the nacelles way up, and then all of a sudden they start to go down again. So it's like when you go from Excelsior to Ambassador to Galaxy, and then all the way to Sovereign. Yeah, it's back to flat again. It's really interesting.
What I like about especially the Enterprise designs is that if you look at them all lined up, and you even include the NX-01 in that, you all see a natural progression. I mean, they all look like they sprung, like they're the next logical step.
I really appreciated that. Like, even from the jump from the original series and Next Gen, you go from A to D, they thought about what it was going to look like in between. And I think that was just great forethought.
Well, not only that, but once you know, even before we saw Generations, because we saw the wall in the observation lounge, we knew that the B was an Excelsior.
Right.
And then when we saw the C in yesterday's Enterprise, it looked like a perfect match in between. That's the intermediate stage in between an Excelsior and a Galaxy. And I loved that about that design.
It's great stuff. Great stuff. This is a... I love the introduction of astrometrics in Voyager. I think this was a great new location. It was big, had the big screen.
It gave Seven somewhere to be.
Yeah, it gave her a station. Like, you know, B'Elanna has engineering, Janeway has a ready room. The doc has a sick bay. Paris basically has the holodeck and the helm. And, you know, like in Seven, I think because she's a unique person with unique abilities, she needed a place that was her own. But then again, you could have said that the cargo bay was hers.
Yeah, but, you know, I felt like the first half of season four, when she's first introduced and before Astrometrics, she's useful and I love her, but she's kind of like a floater. Like, she'll go where she's needed. Here, she actually has like a common place that will be for the rest of the show's run.
You're right. There we go. Like that engineering jacket's starting to flail.
Yeah, it is. But I'll give credit where credit's due. They do a pretty good job of staging it correctly, where you don't see it that much.
Yeah, I think so too. It's funny, they said that most of the special effects in this movie were the EMHs appearing and disappearing. Like, that's what took the most work.
In this episode specifically?
Yes, in this episode specifically.
That's surprising, considering that we see a bunch of ships.
Yeah, it's funny, because they said, like, I started reading behind it, and they said that, like, it was, like, the most work was, like, building the ships and putting them in there, but the most taxing one was, like, while filming, was like framing them up and then having them run out of frame. It's just like whenever you have to do the transporter effect, you know, like, it's just, imagine like somebody beaming as often as they were appearing and disappearing in this show. It's just a lot of beam in and beam out.
Right. You know what I really like about this episode, and we're about to launch into it because the doc is going to be sent over to the other ship. He's about to get going. Voyager is a series that, although I really like a lot, it exists in its own microcosm. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the events in the show are important to that show, but they don't really affect the universe as a whole.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, mm-hmm. you know, Voyager, as much as I love it, is not my favorite series. DS9 was. And I think the reason that I love DS9 so much is that, you know, I felt like a lot of stuff that they did mattered, and it was universe building, which I really like. I like things that are connected, and you could see the connections between them. So when they did this episode and they got to go back to the Delta Quadrant and interact, I felt like this was Voyager breaking out of its little pocket universe. And it was something really special because it didn't do it that often.
You're very right. You're very, very right. This is that moment. This is where they kind of break outside of the bubble, the Delta Quadrant bubble. Now, one thing I do want to mention is that this always bothered me, is that when they, you know, transferred him from the Voyager to the Prometheus, he has his mobile emitter on because he's in Astrometrics. But then as he disappears, the mobile emitter disappears as well.
Really? I never noticed that.
It does. And so, like, obviously, like, when he's over there, he doesn't have it on because you can't transport matter like that. But it, like, they should have had it fall. You know, they've had that happen before where the mobile emitter falls and hits the ground.
I never noticed that. Well, I guess it's convenient that they say later that the whole ship has holo emitters, so.
Right. This is the first time we see those uniforms not in a flashback in the show.
The first contact uniforms.
That's right, which are my absolute favorite Star Trek uniforms.
Yeah, they look great. Well, this is post-war, because right now this is season 4 of Voyager, which means it was airing concurrently with season 6 of DS9. So they're in the middle of the war now, actually.
Right, yeah. And they actually, I love that.
They do like name Andy drop Dick, it, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Andy Dick's like, oh, that, like, no, they have nothing to do with our war with the Dominion. And Doc's like, what? Who?
That's always kind of bothered me, only because I'm that kind of person, and I do let it go, but Voyager technically was lost after they discovered the Dominion.
They discovered the Dominion, yes, but they weren't at war with the Dominion.
No, but the, you know, they don't say, you know, our fight with the Dominion, and the doctor goes, the who? Like, he hasn't even heard of the species.
Well, I mean, the doc, you know, I mean, like, why would the doc investigate that, you know? Like,
I would think it'd be part of the computer, and the doc is the computer.
Well, I mean, he has... See, that's an important distinction. Like, his brain isn't the computer. He has access to the computer.
I guess.
He still has to read everything like that.
The thing that's weird about this ship, and even though I love it so much, is that it looks very sterile because it's all white.
Yeah, we've never seen a Starfleet ship like this, like this color, kind of color palette. And I think they needed to do something like that in order to differentiate it from everything else. Even though the bridge is an Enterprise E redress.
It is. The only time I've ever seen a starship look this sterile and this pristine and this kind of cold isn't the right word, but you get my drift, is the way that the Enterprise looked in the motion picture specifically.
Oh yeah, definitely. Like yeah, if the lighting was just a little bit brighter, I think it would have looked the same. And also, even though this wasn't really a Starfleet ship, but in not Heroes and Demons. I can never ever remember the name of the episode with
describe
Arcturus.
Arcturus. Hope and Fear.
Thank you, Hope and Fear. I knew it started with an H. Hope and Fear, like that, the Dauntless, it wasn't really a Starfleet ship, but the inside was very, very similar to the Prometheus.
Oh, this is great. This is the best part of this ship, is the multi-vector assault mode.
Oh my gosh. I mean, they had to up it. Like, they couldn't just add two more nacelles. They needed to do something distinctly different to give the Romulans a reason to steal the ship.
You saying that the Doctor was the hardest part just baffles me, because because Star Trek, when they do battle stuff, they usually like to reuse footage. This can't be reused. This is all new.
And this is all digital, too. And it's the first appearance of a completely digital Romulan warbird as well.
So, by the way, do you know who the Romulan captain is in this?
Yes, he is crap. He was blonde in The Next Generation. He was the guy who was forcing the other culture to be dependent on drugs, right, or something like that.
Well, not just that. He's even more important. Well, relatively speaking.
Okay, who is he?
He's also Khan's right-hand man in Wrath of Khan.
That's right. So we just saw the multi-vector assault mode, and it's basically Fisher-Price for Starfleet, because mm-hmm. It's like, press the button for who you'd like to attack. It's not even press the button, it's just say it. It's just like, oh yeah, attack Starfleet, and it just does it.
Well, it's going to be very lucky for them later.
Yes, extremely.
All you really need to know is which button to hit for multi-vector assault mode, and then and then it goes from there.
Goes. I remember there was a Simpsons episode where Sideshow Bob hops into... speaking of Sideshow Bob... no, never mind. That's something else. Sideshow Bob, he hops into a Harrier jet, and there's two buttons. It says fly, land. And he said, God bless the idiot-proof military. And that's all that I think of in this moment.
You know what I love is, again, just because I pay attention to detail, they're like, why are you in the wrong uniform?
I know, right? That's the first thing that I thought of, too. But, you know, like, as... You know, like, but just think that if the Federation were on a Romulan ship and we saw somebody else in a different uniform, you know, like, we wouldn't think twice about it. We'd be like, oh, well, maybe that's just the medical, you know, uniform, or just the EMH uniform, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's just, you know... These little details that don't really matter to the story, but things that I notice as someone who's so detail-oriented and so familiar with Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm right there with you. There's a moment later on where the tray, like, he doesn't know which devices do what.
Okay, the one thing that is puzzling is that he didn't knock this Romulan out, and he's about to have this conversation with the other one, so that technically the Romulan can hear everything that they're talking about.
It's true. Maybe he's just in so much pain he can't even hear.
Okay, Andy Dick. Now, when we did this episode on the Delta Quadrant, I did a couple of line readings because I was trying to reenact certain parts of the episode, and... My co-host, you know, every time I do the line, because I have the gay accent, he just cracks up. Please state the nature of the medical emergency. What the hell are you doing in my sick bay?
I love how they're just checking each other out right now. I believe that they would have a contentious relationship, and I just love that they made that happen. Like, there's just too much ego in the both of them to get along.
The thing that I love, too, is that this is obviously the Mark II hologram, right? So
right, it's Mark II, yeah.
So in the larger scale of the universe, would this have been the medical doctor that Bashir would have been had he not been genetically enhanced?
I think so. I think I'm trying to remember, but I do believe that he was working on a Mark II, that Zimmerman was working on a Mark II. Because
this episode happens after that episode. So
yes, then that's what it would have been. And... I always thought, like, as much as I love Andy Dick in this episode, I don't like Andy Dick, but I love him in this episode. I think it would have been really interesting to see a Julian Bashir EMH, but like with a completely different personality. I think it would have been interesting to see that actor in that situation.
Well, we kind of did in that episode where he was created. They gave Julian Bashir the hologram, the same kind of doctor subroutines, and so he started acting like season one doctor.
Right. See, like, now I don't know if the... Oh, here he comes.
Fight with the Dominion. The Who.
I love the little wink to the audience when it's like, just go back and watch the last couple of seasons of Deep Space Nine and you'll catch up.
Right. I'm kind of surprised that never became kind of like, well, I guess it might have been off screen and maybe it wasn't the focus of the episode, but I'm kind of surprised that when they started getting letters from home, the fact that Starfleet was at war was never brought up.
It really needed to be. And I know, like, that's a major criticism of the show. One of the major criticisms of the show is that once they made contact with Starfleet, that they should have at least addressed the Dominion, somehow mentioned it. Like, even if one mention would have placated the fans, that's it.
It certainly would have placated me, but what I did like is how they mentioned, if not the Dominion, then mentioned what happened to the Maquis.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, I gotta be honest with you, is something that I kind of wish was more of a running point in the series, the Maquis.
I think everybody feels that way. I mean, like, we talk about it all the time on Trek.fm and specifically Voyager, and we definitely wish that there was more of aggressiveness, much more of a people not getting along right away. Like in season one was great, just a little bit more season one and build up to it. Like, and have the happy family in like season five, but as long as it's not Battlestar Galactica, that's all that I...
It doesn't have to be that, but like when you're thrown together with people that you don't like... Just because you have to get along with them doesn't mean that you're going to like getting along with them right away.
Exactly. And I mean, we've talked about it so many times, and I definitely agree with you that it needed to be more, but not over the top like BSG was.
No. These two have such a good rapport that this is what makes the episode. And I do remember Robert Picardo saying that they were described in TV Guide as the Frasier and Niles of outer space.
Okay, would medical science really advance that much where he did not know what devices were on his standard medical tray?
Not really, because you think they've only been gone for 3 years, but maybe it has. I mean, our newest computers in 3 years will be totally obsolete, so...
Yeah, apparently... I love that. He's like, we don't use leeches anymore.
But yeah, this relationship makes the episode.
Now we're back in the Delta Quadrant.
You know what I appreciate about going back to the Delta Quadrant is that we're having so much fun in the Alpha Quadrant. You would think that whenever we go back, we get kind of let down because we want to stay there in the Alpha Quadrant. But they make it just as entertaining here, which I got to give them props for.
One thing that I've always really wished, and I know this would not be fun for anybody other than hardcore Star Trek fans, is that after they say engage, okay, after they say make it so, I love these moments right here where they're on the bridge but nothing is going on. I want a bonus episode where it's just 40 minutes of bridge work. Like, it doesn't have to be all the time, but just, like, a bonus episode where it's just, like, engage.
A day in the life episode where, like, even in between the real episodes, you see the boring stuff that happens.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing is that, like, okay, so, like, you know, Janeway just sits down and goes, engage. And she's like, so are we all just going to stare at the screen for the next 12 days? Or what do you want to talk about?
You know? Makes you wonder, like, what does the captain do when they're in the middle of the shift and something's not going on? Do they just sit down and you know, manage all day or what?
Or do they hang out? You know, like what do they do? You know, like there's a few times where we see some of them like goofing off on the bridge where they're just casually having conversations. And I would imagine it's more like that because a starship is pretty self-sufficient if you think about it.
Speaking of which, I would like to see, again, this would only matter to the hardcores. What happens like on the late shifts when nothing happens? Like everyone's in bed. It's the third shift crew. And I've heard this speculated on another podcast. They're like, they have a view screen. Maybe they just like watch episodes of The Simpsons or something.
How amazing would that be? Like just once I want like them to do that where they're like, okay, party on the bridge. And like we're having a viewing party of the latest release or something like that. But here's another question. All right. third shift, night shift, they have the, they dim the lights on the bridge,
which is, you know, counterproductive, by the way. I mean, like,
exactly, why would they do that? And also, what does it matter, like, if, like, they say, like, nothing happens during the late shift? There's no late, there's no, it's, there's no time of day, there's no sun, there, like, it's not like everybody goes to sleep in the universe at the same time.
It doesn't matter, because, like, why would you turn down the lights? You could turn down the lights and, or, you know, because that is their day.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, so, and you're in space. So what does it matter?
So there, like, there's, yeah, exactly. There's no late shift. There's no night shift. There's no day shift. It's all pretty much whatever you want it to be, because there's no revolving sun. That always bothered me. So I did like that, on Star Trek The Next Generation, they said, I think they said third shift. They never said night shift like they did in Voyager.
No, they did, because Data was in command of the Night Watch in Data's day, and the lights turned down then.
You're right, I forgot about that, but I remember just Riker making a stink about, you know, like, shift rotations and first shift and second shift and third shift, but you're right, I forgot about that.
It always made me wonder, too, why you turn off all the lights, why do you make the whole, or in the case of Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock, why you make the whole bridge red during Red Alert? I would think that would make it harder to see things.
I think it's because, like, if you dim the lights, then your instruments glow a little bit more. It's kind of like when you, you're driving in your car and you turn on your lights, it dims everything inside. I don't know, something like that.
There are. I'm not condemned to a sick bay.
Yeah, their banter back and forth was pretty priceless. But, like, I love how, like, because the Doc has a gigantic ego.
And so does this guy.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying, is that, like, the Doc has a gigantic ego, and he throws it around all over Voyager, and he has the talent and the smarts to back it up, because he's one of the most advanced things on the ship. But then he goes to another ship, and someone's just a little bit more advanced than him, and so all of a sudden he has to deal with it. That could be one of the greatest jokes in all of Star Trek history, is that he made an addition to his program.
For sexual relations. Okay, they're about to do their counterinsurgency thing, which the Doctor has already done, let's not forget, in Basics.
That's right, yeah. He's an experienced Doc, not like this child, this veritable childlike hologram.
Although a lot of that in Basics was Brad Dourif.
That was a good episode. And Brad Dourif is an awesome actor.
Yeah.
Like, I love this because Andy Dick Doc is... he's so brand new that he doesn't know how to enter a corridor.
Although you wouldn't think, like, I've never been on a starship before, and even if I've never seen Star Trek, I wouldn't think you would go in backwards.
That's the thing, is that, like, if you think about it as programmers, is that why would they, like, that's one of those things that would just fall to the wayside of programming.
Right.
Like, how to enter a corridor.
It's the Enterprise E bridge, but it looks... I can't remember if it's also, or at one time was also, the Enterprise A bridge, because it looks that big, too. It even looks... parts of it look like the Enterprise A bridge.
Well, all I know is that they said it was an Enterprise E redress.
I'm sure it
Enterprise
was.
Enterprise A would have been a while ago.
Yeah, I know, but well, the chairs are definitely from the Enterprise A. That's for sure.
They always do such a good job with redresses. I'm always amazed at what they can do with a bridge redress. I think the only time when it was blaringly obvious was in Undiscovered Country.
But the Undiscovered Country bridge looks so good. Like,
well, I'm not even talking about the bridge. I'm talking about, like, the dining room and engineering.
Oh, well, yeah. Or that was just the Enterprise A. I mean, because except for the bridge, all other parts of the Enterprise A are just the next gen sets.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is that, like that was the only time when I didn't think they did a particularly good job of redressing the set to make it look like something different.
I mean, they didn't even do, like, the corridors really give it away, and then even the transporter room is just the transporter room.
I know, it's pretty rough. I know they were trying to save money, but, like, I'm not knocking the movie. Undiscovered Country is my favorite original series
movie.
Mine
too, actually.
I love these moments between Paris and Kim.
I love this subplot of Paris might be stuck with being the doctor from now on, which I don't know how that happens, because I know that he's the most experienced, but in that episode he says he only had 2 semesters of biochemistry, so clearly that a doctor makes. So.
I know, right? Okay, and we're on a crew, okay, that most of them have been through Starfleet Academy, okay? So they've had to have at least taken biochem. Like, he can't be the only person who has taken 2 semesters of biochem.
Doesn't it bother? I mean, I know the Voyager crew is small. I get it. It's 150 plus people. But one doctor and one nurse for 150 plus people.
Yeah.
Like in that first episode, like when they go, there's no more medical staff.
See, that's the thing, is like there at least has to be on like medics of some kind.
Yeah,
like,
where are all the teal shirts? Like, where are the orderlies? You know what I mean?
Like, and we see them at the beginning of the show, where like whenever there's a disaster, we see a whole bunch of blue shirts just start coming in and helping out. And I'm just like, there's got to be at least someone with a science background who knows more than Tom.
I mean, when they call medical emergency in a certain place of the ship, does that mean the doctor himself has to go running everywhere? Because that's not what happened in the other ones. Like, it was always the doctor and somebody else.
Yeah. Or the doctor would just wait in sickbay for them to bring him, like, bring whomever to sickbay. You
know? Right. Oh, yeah, this is when they still didn't like each other, Torres and Seven. Yeah.
Seeing Torres and Seven in a scene together is always a good time for me.
It was, but I have to say, and maybe this is just a symptom of watching them week after week, by season 5, when this is still going, it's starting to get old.
Yeah. But then, okay, imagine, okay, like, you said that you wanted, you know, more Maquis and Starfleet stuff. Imagine this all the time.
It is realistic, and I give it that much. I definitely do. I'm glad, though, at the beginning of season 7, they kind of put it to rest, though.
I need to figure out how tall her heels actually are, because Jeri Ryan is not that tall.
How do you know?
Watch Scorpion. Like, where
she's in flats.
She's in flats, and she is not taller than Chakotay. And Chakotay's just average height.
Oh, this is a very small point of this episode, but it does introduce the Hirogen, which I gotta say, that was the hardest thing about watching seasons 1 and 2, is because I really, really hate the Kazon. I thought they were terrible villains, and they just got overused way too much. They were so dumb. So, like, the Vidians were good, though, but the Hirogen, I gotta say, in rewatching Voyager, and if we exclude the Borg, they were probably my favorite of the Delta Quadrant villains.
Yeah, Hirogen and 8472 were some of my favorites. I didn't really understand all the hate that the Kazon got. Like, I mean, I'm not saying I like them, oof, but like, man, going online, everybody's just like, burn it with fire.
Look, I'm one of those people.
I love how you're trying to interrogate it. I can't even speak.
Interrogate
a hologram, yeah.
Okay, if you want to talk about like not very well disguised redresses, these quarters are just a Voyager quarter set.
See, that one I can forgive, though, because quarters are quarters, you know? Like, they're just, like, plopping a quarter here.
Yeah, I know, but they didn't even change the color scheme. It's just the Voyager one. I mean, if they had changed...
Oh, okay,
if
they didn't make it bright?
They didn't make it white or bright or anything like that. It's just the Voyager set.
I don't like Romulans.
Like, ever?
Yeah. I don't. I never... I mean, like, I feel like this is kind of like Star Trek Anonymous right now, where I don't know,
I like the Romulans, but I feel like when they appeared, it was kind of the same deal. What I think the more interesting of the sneaky, you never know what they're going to do races, I say Cardassians were better than Romulans. I love the Cardassians.
I agree. I think Cardassians are better than Romulans. I don't know, I just never, like, fell in love with them. I know, like, a lot of people, like, fall in love with the Klingons a whole lot more than the Romulans, but I just never really got Romulan love. Didn't get it.
No, I like the Romulans just fine, but if you're asking me which is my favorite sneaky race, it's much more the Cardassians.
Sneaky, sneaky.
Which, if you think about it, if you compare the two, they're remarkably similar.
Yeah, they really are. Like, I'm surprised more people haven't complained about that, about how similar the Cardassians are with the Romulans, because, like the, with the Tal Shiar and the Obsidian Order, they have so many parallels.
But they gave them a niche. Like I think having them be the ones behind the occupation of Bajor, and then giving, like, what we got with the Cardassians is that we didn't get so much with the Romulans are unique, interesting characters, like identifiable characters. Like there's no Gul Dukat or Garak for the Romulans. I mean, the closest you ever come to a recurring Romulan is Tomalak.
And that was just a few scenes here and there. I love how he's pantomiming typing like we all do. Try to say I wrote him an email without moving your fingers right now.
The thing that I love is, you know, just how they both have the inspiration to exaggerate their heroics all the time, because Doctor does this all the time.
Constantly. I remember there was a few times in the series where the doc would say, like, and then, you know, like I performed a scan and found out about this enzyme, and Janeway's just like it's okay, like I don't need the blow by blow, and he's like all right, it's a story for another time, I guess, you know, like, he wants to let them know how genius he actually is.
He's so indulgent. I mean, a few weeks ago we just reviewed Author because we're at the end of season 7. That's nothing but the Doctor's indulgence for half the episode.
How would you not know where the helm is?
I mean, even the Doctor. I mean, it's basically the same layout.
Like, look at this. Okay, so they have an extra big helm, just like on Voyager, but they only have one chair in the middle, so they don't have anything for an XO or a counselor. I mean, where's the counselor going to sit? I think that's the biggest question. You need your counselor.
The counselor. Regardless, they had two chairs at the helm. There were two people sitting up there earlier in the episode. I always found it funny that...
I love that. I wish for somehow, like, he called him that again, or like that stuck somehow, where he's like, Mr. I can leave my ship. The breathing on the neckline was actually Picardo's idea. He called up Brennan Braga and said this needs to happen because it's funny, and they put it in the show. Apparently that happened like 5 other times.
It is funny. He was right. The thing that I find hilarious, though, is that you talk about the counselor. Why was she always on the bridge and sitting right next to the captain?
I think that's the colossal Star Trek joke, is that there would be no reason for her to be there. But she's more of she's more of Picard's advisor. I think that's the only reason why, is because she's not just a counselor, but she's Picard's advisor.
Furthermore, what does her console do exactly?
She has on the E?
Well, not only on the E, she had one on the D.
Well, I think that was, I don't think that was specifically hers.
No, Riker and Troy both had consoles next to their chairs on the D.
No, I remember, but you never saw her use it.
Oh, you sure you did? A couple times.
I think you remember, you see Riker using his, but you don't remember seeing Deanna use hers. Like, all I can think of is, like, when in emergency situations she would track personnel, I think. That's all that I remember her doing.
No, but, like, even on the E, when she gets the bigger console, Captain, counseling emergency on deck 2, someone's really upset.
Yeah, they don't know if their life is going the right direction with their career. This is probably my least favorite hairstyle of Janeway's.
The in-between phase?
The in-between, yeah, from season 4.
I don't know, that bun, I don't mind it so much, but it made her look, like, Kate Mulgrew is a beautiful woman, but mm-hmm. that bun, not that it's an insult, but it kind of made her look 10 years older, because it's just so severe.
I prefer to think of it as the command bun. But in season 5, that has to be, I think, her best hairstyle. But
yeah, well, what she gets in season 5 to the end of the series is the best that she looks, as far as hairstyles go.
They could have done more with 7, really. Like, I don't want to get into a tirade about her outfit, but they could have varied it up a little bit more.
I mean, as far as hairstyle or as far as uniform went?
Yeah, just the look all over, but yeah, hairstyle. Like, they even varied it up with B'Elanna. And, like, I missed that. They did, like, those braid things one time. I was like, it was only in a handful of episodes, not even, like, one or two. And I was just like, dude, like, that's fun. Like, they're on the show for 7 years. These are people who are on the show for seven, like who are on the ship for 7 years, you're going to try something different with your hair.
Torres, I mean, for the whole of season six, she's got frizzy hair.
Mm-hmm. That's crimped or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, like, you have the straight back jet black look of Harry Kim.
And then the Borg assimilated her, and then her hair all fell out and it grew back in straight.
I guess Paris goes through a few changes, but I think that's because McNeil was losing it a little bit.
Well, not to insult McNeil at all, but he in this season particularly, in season four, you can see he gains a little bit of weight. But I do remember hearing that his wife was pregnant at the time, and you always get that sympathy gain.
So. Yeah, and I feel like this hairstyle for Paris always kind of made him look a little boyish, like they were going for at the beginning of the show. But then they do, like in season six, they do like the straight down short.
I love them trying to create a new doctor. As if these two could do it. I'm sorry, but you know.
Well, I feel like out of everybody, it would be B'Elanna and Kim, I think, would be the two that would be able to do it. But I love how Kim is like, he's not giving it his all, and you know he's not giving it his all. He's just like, all right, I'll try. And that's why it doesn't work.
I love that the fact that they can't shut him up. I wonder if Picard had to memorize all this, or if he's just reading it off of something, because that's a lot.
I wondered that as well, and so I've watched this a couple of times. His eyes are moving to the point where you know that he's reading something off of a teleprompter.
Which I don't blame him, because how do you memorize Grey's Anatomy if you're not if you're not familiar with it?
Yeah, no, I'm not criticizing him whatsoever. I love how they're screaming. Oh no, we're losing him!
And the look on Kim's face is like, well, I tried. It's all you now, pal.
It's perfect. The perfect facial expression.
Oh, it's not for him, it's for you.
Space opera. Da-na-na. Yeah, this is the first full CGI Romulan warbird.
You know, for 1998, it looks pretty good.
I've always been impressed with Voyager special effects, whether they were models or they were CGI. I think they were just fantastic.
There's a couple that it wasn't so good, but for the most part, I agree with you. Like, we just watched that episode Natural Law, where Seven and Chakotay are stranded with the natives.
Okay. You had to bring up that one, right?
And there's the point where Seven stands in front of a waterfall, and it's such a PS2 looking waterfall.
Well, I was mainly thinking ships, but even in that one, like where this shuttlecraft crashed, in that force field, it looked pretty bad. I think they had to scale back the money on their special effects in that episode.
The thing that I noticed with season seven is that I feel like they had to scale back a lot, because I think that at that point all the money was going to Enterprise for season one.
Mm. I love the voice that the doc puts on. This is the Prometheus. I'm totally a Romulan right now.
That makes him sound more Romulan. Identify. You first.
Oh, man. Like, this is, this is when it starts to get into the absurd, but it works.
Yeah, it does. If you hadn't bought the comedy or their relationship up to this point, it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, if they started with this, you guys would, everybody would have just been like, this is absurd, this is crazy, this is going to work.
This is starting with a 10 when you should start with like a 5.
Exactly. Jeez, that was quick. One hit down to 20%.
Yeah, I always hated that about Star Trek. Starfleet's here, but they're also firing at us. I love the fact, can I just say, as a DS9 fan, I love the fact that there are Defiants here.
Yeah, it's a Defiant class ships, which, I mean, I want to know how many are out there, because I keep forgetting I always think that it's unique for some reason, that the Defiant is a unique ship.
The one that they have in DS9 was the prototype, but
right.
I would think that, because it makes sense, they're in the middle of a war, it's a prototype that's now working.
Yeah,
why wouldn't right. you make more of them?
I think there was something fun about the Defiant class ships, and I can't remember what it was.
Obviously, they did make more of them because, you know, spoiler alert for 20 years old, when the Defiant is destroyed, they get another one. Which I'm always kind of sad that they didn't call the Defiant A. If it works for the Enterprise, why can't it work for the Defiant?
Yeah, I was disappointed with that, too. That was a prime opportunity to have a throwback to the Search for Spock. Or, no, not Search for Spock, Voyage Home.
Why not NX-74205A? You know.
Well, I mean, I think they should have taken away the NX.
Even if they wanted to keep the NX, just put the A on there.
Yeah, no, I agree. Whether they took away the NX or brought it in there or changed it to USS.
The wrong ship.
I love that you just have to tell. Yeah, on this ship, that's possible.
Well, I don't see why it wouldn't be possible if you really screwed it up. I mean, you do have to focus targeting on something.
Okay, all right. I know it's just for comedy, but the thing is that we established in Next Gen that if you just plop your hand on the console, it doesn't actually do anything. Like, it recognizes when someone's just putting their hand down as opposed to, like, hitting a button.
Yeah, but that was established in an episode that I didn't really like, so we could forget about that.
Oh, okay. Well, I forgot that was the rules. Because think about how many times Riker sat down on a console that was like Worf's console. That
put his foot up on Data's console.
And then blow away whatever was in front of them. See, that was such a badass shot with the primary hull, just the curving up and going into the... into the Y-axis and just destroying the Romulan warbird. So much fun.
I love how they can now indulge together.
Yeah. Apparently the two extras coming in with their phaser rifles were two DS9 extras because they had the costumes already fitted for them.
That makes sense.
And also the compression rifles are Voyager style, yeah, not Deep Space Nine style.
And even the Deep Space Nine style should be wrong. It should be First Contact style at this point.
You're right. That always bothered me when they tried to sneak in the First Contact weapons into Voyager. They slowly transitioned into First Contact.
Well, they all upgraded their stuff beyond where it should have been.
Yeah, like the hand rifles, the phaser rifles.
Even the tricorders.
And even the tricorders, yeah. I don't know. Hand rifles isn't a thing. I meant the hand phasers. But apparently they shot this differently the first time, where they had tons and tons of people in the mess hall, like a whole bunch of people in the mess hall. And they said that it was to the Waltons, where everybody was hugging and crying, and so they just went for small and intimate.
This is perfect, actually.
Yeah, I think so too. I love that we'd get to see the Prometheus again in Endgame on their ride home to Earth.
Do we? Oh, yes, yeah. We do. Yeah. I forgot about
that. I thought that was a really nice touch. So 14 months ago, at this point, would have been season 3.
Yeah, season 3. So it would have been right before the war was starting in the Alpha Quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of makes sense, because if things were heating up, maybe, you know, searching for a ship that's been missing for 3 years at that point, kind of a low priority thing.
I love this line. You're no longer alone. We have this track in.
This final line is perfect, actually, from Janeway.
That look at the end. That Kate Mulgrew. Yeah.
That Kate Mulgrew almost crying look.
Yeah. I'm not going to cry. It's going to be okay. All right, everyone. Well, that was it. That was Message in a Bottle. We hope you enjoyed it just as much as we did, and hopefully, if you didn't laugh with us, hopefully you learned something today.
If you didn't laugh with us, you have no sense of humor, let's be honest.
But before we go, we'd like to talk about our sponsor, so let's hear a little bit about that. Our sponsor for the show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to, but never thought you had the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers, Audible has something for everyone. You'll be happy to hear that both Mosaic and Pathways are available from Audible. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank you and Audible for supporting To the Journey and Trek.fm. And also, you can become a Trek.fm patron on Patreon and help us keep Star Trek Talk coming every week. We have great perks for you at patreon.com/trekfm. Also, we'd like to thank our associate producers Kenneth Tripp and Jamie Deuce, as well as Lisa Stevens. All right, well, that's our show. Coming up next week is a wee bit of a surprise, so I don't really want to talk about it just now. But, Matt, where could we find you online?
You can find me online at mhansen0207 on Twitter. That's H-A-N-S-E-N. You can find me, at least for the next couple weeks, at the Delta Quadrant as I wrap up the show, although all of our back catalog is available over on the TrekMate Network at trekmate.org.uk. And, you know, a little plug for us, Tristan, you can find both of us over at the Nerd Party. If you like the rapport that we had during this show, check out our other show. We talk not just Star Trek, but various nerd topics. So lots of fun there.
It is fantastic. If I do say so myself, you can go to thenerdparty.com or go to facebook.com/thenerdparty, and you'll find anything and everything that you can there. Well, as I said, next week is a wee bit of a surprise, but you'll have to tune in to find out. Until then, this has been To the Journey.
To the Journey!